Good afternoon. This is Richmond Independent Radio News for Friday, June 10th, 2005. I'm Lauren Ball. This week, we speak with the Democratic candidates for the Office of Commonwealth Attorney, who will face each other in next week's primary election.
Kids leave school, go out on the street. They act up, but many of them go out there to earn money.
The justice system is for everybody. I don't want anyone to walk out of a courtroom and feel like they didn't get a fair shake.
We also go back to the budget issue as the dispute between Mayor Wilder and City Council heats up.
He feels very strongly that there's no reason for this case to end up in court. It's not even a case. There's no reason for this matter to end up in court.
And we present a citizen commentary on evil. Those stories and more coming up after these headlines.
For WRIR News, I'm Matt Beckwith. Volunteers will line the bank of the James River tomorrow as James River Regional Cleanup Day focuses efforts on 10 different areas along the shoreline. The event, which is in its sixth year, starts at 8:45 a.m. and includes both the cleaning of debris from the shoreline as well as the river itself. Volunteers working in the river will bring their own canoes and are required to have the proper permits for use before entering the river. Volunteers in the River City area will work at 24 different sites in the James River Park system, starting at the Reedy Creek entrance on Riverside Drive. There are also sites in Chesterfield, Goochland, and Cumberland counties, among others. The event is organized by the James River Advisory Council and is sponsored by an extended network of civic and nonprofit organizations, as well as government agencies. The Parks and Recreation Department of the City of Richmond is among those agencies. Ralph White is the James River Park Manager for the City of Richmond.
We anticipate a large crowd. Weather should be good. We've had over 250 people sign up, so including the walk-ins, I should imagine we'll be somewhere between 275 and 300. But we do have enough for everybody to do.
For local volunteers, work will conclude at 1 p.m. with a cookout at Reedy Creek. It has been a busy spring for a couple of downtown lovebirds. The peregrine falcons have returned to nest in downtown Richmond for the third consecutive year, and this time they have successfully mated. Earlier this week, four young peregrine falcons were released from the watchful care of the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. An endangered species from 1970 to 1999, efforts have been made to reintroduce these native Virginia birds back to the wild. This process, called hacking, protects the young until they are strong enough to fend for themselves and take their first flight. Here in the city, falcons play an important role in our ecosystem and help control the pigeon population. In the hacking process, the young peregrines are placed in a cage temporarily to protect them from urban perils. They are prevented from taking flight until they are strong enough to do so, and care is taken to avoid contact with humans. This week, Virginia game officials let the 40-day-old birds loose. Two were successfully moved to Hawksbill Mountain Hack Site at Shenandoah National Park. The other two were released this week in downtown Richmond and completed their first successful flight. Ray Fernald is the manager of non-game and environmental programs with the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries.
One falcon walked out and hopped up onto the ledge almost immediately, and it then just kind of hopped around and walked around on the ledge for about an hour. The other falcon chick remained in the pen for about an hour, and then it flew directly from the pen and made a big circle around the building and gaining altitude and landed on the SunTrust building about 50, 60 feet higher than it had taken off from. Not to be outdone, then the second falcon, which was still standing on the ledge, took off about 10 minutes later and made the exact same flight.
The birds will remain in Richmond until fall, where they will likely fly south for the winter. The best view of these birds is from the plaza at 8th and Carey Streets near the SunTrust Bank building. Vendors of organic produce and homemade crafts will share the 17th Street Farmers Market with some new friends this weekend. Saturday's Mucho Market is transformed into Animalia Pet Fet tomorrow, as pet owners are invited to bring their animals down for some pet-friendly festivities. Lila Kearns, manager of the farmers market, says the event will feature a variety of pet-related attractions.
So our vendors will be selling specially pet-themed items, and we'll also have some new vendors coming down who have, you know, animal boutiques. We'll have the SPCA, local rescue organizations, animal resource groups, entertainers, and the Saturday Mucho Market vendors will be selling their best pet-themed products, baked goods, crafts, and more.
There will be a petting zoo and art activities for children, as well as contests and a pet parade. All pets are welcome, although leashes and carriers are required, along with current vaccinations. Angling season is in full swing in the James River, but fishers beware, as some spots are safer than others. While it has been 18 years since the ban on recreational and commercial fishing in the James was lifted, there are still spots where the fish contain questionably high levels of ketone and PCB, the chemicals responsible for the ban in the first place. Ketone contamination dates back to the 1970s, when a Hopewell chemical plant dumped almost 40,000 pounds of this pesticide into the James River. PCBs, no longer manufactured, are coolant chemicals found in older electrical equipment. Neither dissolve in the water, both sink into the riverbeds, which is exactly where bottom feeders like carp and catfish, typical James River catch, like to hang out. Julia Dixon of the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries says that contaminated fish are not necessarily a threat.
A vast number of anglers do catch and release, and any of those contaminants in no way affect that. They just because you're fishing doesn't mean you're eating. The pleasure of fishing is part of it's just being out there and having a fish on the line, and you can just as easily release that fish live.
Anglers looking to take their catch home should be okay as long as they make sure to take a few precautions. Stay on the northwest side of the city, always bake, broil, or grill the catch, as deep frying seals in PCBs, and go for the smaller fish, since the longer the fish swims in polluted waters, the more toxins it harbors. For more information on fishing in the James River, contact the Richmond Department of Parks and Recreation. This is WRIR News.
For WRIR News, I'm Lauren Ball. The mayor's office on the second floor of City Hall is only a few paces away from City Council chambers, but in recent weeks, the division between these two branches of city government has never been greater. Last night, in a closed session, the council drew up their battle plans for the ongoing political turf war. WRIR's Dustin Richardson was there.
The matter of contention last night was the legality of the time frame in which City Council passed their version of the 2005-2006 city budget. The new city charter that allowed the restructuring of Richmond's government to include a popularly elected mayor stipulates that a budget must be approved during a council meeting no later than the end of May, and council finally did approve their version on the 31st. But Mayor Wilder has declared that budget invalid because it was approved not during a regular council meeting, but in a special session. Bill Ferrer is Wilder's press secretary.
He feels very strongly that there's no reason for this case to end up in court. It's not even a case. There's no reason for this matter to end up in court.
In a press release issued last week, Wilder is quoted as saying that the only city budget that may now be legally implemented is the one he submitted back in April, and that there is no legal recourse the council may take. But legal recourse is exactly what council has in mind. They have retained the services of the law firm of LeClaire Ryan, and, after meeting behind closed doors, council representatives are confident that their budget was passed in a timely and legally binding manner. Buddy Allen Jr. is the lead attorney for council, which has been advised not to personally comment on the matter.
Our advice was that they should file a lawsuit in the circuit court of the city of Richmond to have the court rule that the council's budget was the one, only, and legitimate budget.
Furthermore, council asserts that any spending by the Wilder administration not included in their budget will be considered by them to be an illegal act.
The council passed its budget as was required by the city charter on May 31, and as far as council is concerned, that's the budget.
Allen also went on to add that if the council's budget is not signed by Wilder's chief administrative officer, William Harrell, by July 1st, when the fiscal year ends, they're prepared to file a lawsuit, in which case it would be up to the circuit court to interpret the charter and set legal precedent.
You've got a brand new system of government, and you've got a legislature that took an old charter and went through it and tried to come up with, okay, how's this going to work?
It now seems that both sides are going head-to-head in what amounts to a political game of chicken, and with less than 4 weeks before a new budget must be enacted, neither shows any sign of flinching. For WRIR, I'm Dustin Richardson at City Hall.
This just in. Late this afternoon, the Wilder administration issued a release responding to last night's closed session council meeting. In the release, Chief Administrative Officer William E. Harrell is quoted as saying, quote, "After working extensively with Council on a compromise this week at its request, we are disappointed and very surprised that City Council is now choosing to speak through outside legal counsel and with threat of a lawsuit. We would all be better advised to deal with each other directly so that we can get on with the business of the city," end quote. He goes on to say, quote, "The administration has acted in good faith to resolve the budget impasse in a cooperative and productive manner. Council's insistence on pursuing a lawsuit effectively restricts our ability to do so further at this time," end quote. Stay tuned to WRIR for more updates as they occur. When Richmond Commonwealth's attorney David Hicks announced his retirement, three Democratic candidates stepped up to run for the job. One since dropped out, leaving it between Mike Herring and Michelle Welsh. As there is no Republican candidate in the race, Tuesday's primary will, in effect, elect the new official. Mike Herring is a native of Richmond, graduating from John Marshall High School and thereafter receiving his undergraduate and law degrees from the University of Virginia. He previously served as Richmond's deputy Commonwealth's attorney for 5 years in the mid-1990s, first for former Commonwealth's attorney Joe Morrissey, then for Morrissey's successor David Hicks. Deputy Commonwealth's attorney Michelle Welsh serves as the lead prosecutor in the Community Assisted Public Safety Program. She also graduated from the University of Virginia and then received her law degree at the University of Richmond in 1996. WRIR's Christopher Maxwell and Vicki Ward recently interviewed Michelle Welsh and Mike Herring, respectively.
Both candidates have pledged to reduce Richmond's truancy rate and offsetting juvenile delinquency, working with the Wilder administration to decrease violent crime and drug sales. Michelle Welsh and Mike Herring also each recognize the effect of urban blight and the increased crime rate.
We have so much open-air drug activity near blighted houses because it sends the message that no one cares about the neighborhood, they're going to tolerate that kind of activity, and that the police aren't watching. So we have to absolutely get rid of the blighted properties to get rid of our crime rate. Well, we don't necessarily tear down the building. What we do is we try to get the owner to be responsible in either cleaning up the building and renting it to good people or selling it to someone who's going to take care of it. But what we would hope is we have so many historic homes that we could get them, you know, what I want is for them to sell it to someone who will care about it and will renovate it for a dollar. If you're going to have a house that you're going to let just deteriorate and bring down the neighborhood, you need to be to pay for that right to do that. I don't think you should have the God-given right to bring down the neighborhood just because you're a slumlord or you're an absentee landlord. I think you need to take care of your property. You concentrate resources in that neighborhood. You beef up our tax enforcement. You know, we have a lot of delinquent properties that we need to go after and, you know, and take that property away from that bad owner. What I propose to do is to assess them at 3 times the tax rate. I've taken that to our current administration. I'm hoping that they'll do that. Washington does it, and it works. But I think the political will is more about what this is about. I'm hoping with our new mayor, just like everyone else, that, you know, he really does have the political will to do it. I think either changing the tax code so that you can tax someone at 3 times the tax rate for blighted properties or assessing them at 3 times the tax rate. You wouldn't have to change the code to do that. Rodney Monroe is a breath of fresh air. You know, he really understands that we need to go back to community policing and that we need to build that trust in the community. He is very much acting on that. As the head prosecutor, I'm going to have community prosecutors in every part of town. You would get to know them. You would trust them because they're in your community. You'll call them with your problems, and they will solve your problems, no matter how small, no matter how big. And if you're a victim of crime, they're never going to tell you that that's not important, that the homicide rate's more important. Bottom line is, if you're a victim of a crime, you deserve respect, you need to be listened to, and your problem needs to be solved. And those are the things I think will make the long-term impact on trust in the community, is building that trust over time. And I see that things are changing. I'm hopeful that things are changing. And as your community prosecutor, I've worked hard to build that trust in the community.
Tell us again about your work with Three Strikes and You're Out and jailing versus anything else.
Well, what I said earlier was that three strikes you're out just built more prisons. It didn't solve the underlying problems of crime. It didn't reduce crime. It just built more prisons. So what I was saying in as part of my platform, what I want to do is I want to focus on repeat offending, where people are just continually repeating the same crime over and over again, or leading to more violent crime. And the way I propose to do that is to give 50 hours of life skills training for every defendant. And what I mean by life skills training is job training, making sure they have mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, parenting skills, and making sure they have a home when they get out of jail so that they don't go back to the same old crowd and fall into the same bad habits and repeat offend. We actually are trying to get this instituted now, and I want it to be part of my platform, and I'm already working on it.
In my interview with Mike Herring, I asked him if he would work with the Richmond School Board as well as the Wilder administration to deter truancy that may lead to the temptation toward more severe juvenile offenses.
I believe that if you can identify a marginal juvenile offender, that is someone who, for example, has had a petition issued because he or she was in a stolen car or is experimenting with narcotics. If you can identify that young person and put him in touch with services and programming that are going to expose him to positive examples, odds are that kid will not reappear in the juvenile justice system. That is what I'm convinced of. That is what I intend to do as your Commonwealth's attorney. I want to separate out from the greater population of juvenile offenders those who are marginal and commit crimes because of lapses in judgment from those who, although they are young, have already begun to develop and manifest predatory tendencies.
So you'll be working with the school board to alleviate the high rate of truancy that would lead to a temptation of crime?
Yes. If a child is skipping school, that's an indication of some underlying dysfunction already. And if we send a message to teenagers that either go to school or you're going to be punished, or go to school or your parents are going to be punished, you may get them in school, but you won't get their hearts and minds there. You'll have bodies there not availing themselves of what school has to offer. And I don't think that's a real solution to truancy. I mean, what we want is people to go to school, get educations, and acquire skills, come out and be productive citizens, not just go to school and sit there for 6 hours so the truancy stats go down. Kids leave school, go out on the street, they act up, but many of them go out there to earn money. And that's because they don't see the benefit down the road of an SOL equilibrium or, you know, a traditional three R's leading to a job. So get them while they're young, while they're hungry, while their minds are open to accepting skills, and teach them something vocational as well as traditionally educational. You go out into certain communities and you talk to people, and they'll tell you the drug crime is just as bad as it always has been, and in fact it's worse in many parts of the city. And unfortunately, we haven't policed it in a way that has historically been effective. There's been very little attention paid to street-level narcotics policing prior to Chief Monroe's arrival. When the chief implements what I understand to be part of his strategy, which is to combat street-level narcotics, I hope that your listeners will begin to hear more statistics on drug arrests. And by drug arrests, I mean something other than possession of cocaine or possession of narcotics. They need to be hearing about initiatives that dismantle supply networks, conspiracies. They need to be hearing about how street-level people were used to identify regional suppliers. That, to me, is the real war that not only have we not been effectively fighting, but it certainly hasn't been getting the attention that it should. The groups of young men and now young women working on the corner are working in a syndicated way. In their eyes, selling the narcotics is a business. There are people who supply the product, there are people who manufacture and produce and distribute the product, and then there are people who actually retail and sell the product on the street. And when one of the street retailers or dealers is taken out of the picture, somebody else quickly fills his spot, because every second, every minute that that spot is down, it's money that's being lost to the suppliers and the distributors. It's a business model. It's an illegal business model. People in the communities have seen it happen time and time again, that you arrest one dealer He or she is gone for 11 to 14 months or 2 years, but within a matter of days and sometimes hours, the vacancy that was created by that person's arrest on the corner is refilled by someone else. I think the idea of cooperation between the different agencies in different jurisdictions is critical to combating predatory crime, especially if it involves narcotics, which always moves across city and county lines. For someone to come up and say, listen, I shut down a crack house, or I cleaned the prostitutes off of your corner, therefore, you should conclude that that pocket or that sphere of crime has been eliminated, is wrong. It may have been displaced and moved to a different location and become someone else's problem. But the only way to prove that it has been eliminated is to show me the outcomes of the indictments against the people who were running the crack house, and not just the landlord, but the dealers who were actually selling the cocaine and the heroin out of the crack house. Don't just show me that the house was shut down. Again, if you're making thousands of dollars, you're not going to pack up shop and leave because it's been made inconvenient. You're going to go somewhere else to make your money. I'm going to come in with long-term solutions to blight. If I'm going to take the time and the initiative to investigate a blighted area that happens to be infested with narcotics or prostitution, I want the communities and I want the city to come in behind me and do something to beef up and refurbish the area so that you don't have another infestation 6 to 8 months later. That, to me, is a long-term solution to it.
Do you think you're going to have to hire additional staff to do that?
No. Community prosecution is... been successful in many cities, and it was something that the office began to experiment with toward the late 90s. Essentially, what it means is you have prosecutors assigned to a particular area of the city, and the responsibility of that prosecutor is to go out and interface with community associations and neighborhoods, get to know the citizens in the communities so that you are on the one hand, a law enforcement official, but you're also a resource. You're the person that the community groups can go to when they have questions about crime trends, when they have questions about the way cases play out in court. And then it would be the responsibility of that prosecutor to have some involvement in certain cases that come out of that part of the city that they're assigned to. And in theory, what it does is it builds a relationship of confidence and trust between the community and the prosecutor that works with that community on a regular basis. In certain parts of the city where people are dying and where lives are being ruined because of narcotics and gun violence, I'm telling you straight up, that's going to be my target. I know that in certain other parts of the city, people are very concerned about graffiti and prostitution, and I'm going to continue the same initiatives that the office has underway.
Richmond SPCA is now offering free spaying and neutering to pets of qualified individuals living in Richmond, Henrico, Hanover, Chesterfield, and Goochland. They'll even pick up your pet if you'd like. A free rabies vaccination will be included. Having your pet spayed or neutered will improve their health and help save the lives of homeless animals in our community. More information and appointments are available by calling the Richmond SPCA Spay-Neuter Helpline at 521-1300.
Ever notice how other radio stations think about music and news?
Sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear.
Ever wonder where their programming decisions are made?
We are controlling transmission.
At WRIR, we think the community should be a big part of the station. To find out how you can participate in creating the future of Richmond Independent Radio, log on to WRIR.org.
You are about to participate in a great adventure.
And if you like what you hear on the air, tell a friend.
For WRIR News, I'm Lauren Ball. This week, WRIR News presents a commentary from Richmonder Kim Thomas on the subject of evil.
Evil. Evil is a word that has been used quite a bit lately, describing people and world events at large. The meter maid is evil, traffic is evil, and of course, our beloved is evil, usually because of the trash, or maybe the dishes. You know, the really important stuff. The funny thing is that before 9/11, You never really heard anyone use the word evil to describe anything, or maybe, more importantly, anyone. This came up in a conversation I had with someone I admire and respect. Fair-minded, sound intelligence, quality education, and a white male Christian Republican. At some point, I brought up this subject of evil, and he agreed the word has become somewhat overused. I told him I didn't believe people were evil. The things they do could be called evil, but they're not evil. Oh, he assured me, people are evil, very evil. Look at Saddam. Look at Hitler. What about Idi Amin? I agreed, but they're not evil. What? Of course they are evil. Don't you think it takes an evil person to do those things? He insisted. No, I said. People are good, have merit, worth. Some say we are all sons of God, born in His image. If this is true, and people are evil, then God is fallible. Because God would not knowingly create evil people, would He? My friend was aghast. Could God be fallible? He emphatically denied that the possibility could even exist. Then how can people be evil? They are evil, he responded. They choose to do evil things, and that makes them evil. And Frank said, I believe in the good of man. I do too, Anne.
That's it for this edition of Richmond Independent Radio News. I'm Lauren Ball. I'd like to thank all the volunteers who worked on this week's program: Matt Beckwith, Nancy Lee, Christopher Maxwell, Dustin Richardson, and Victoria Ward. If you would like to comment on anything you heard today, or if you would like to volunteer, send an email to news@wrir.org. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.